grateful to be here with Dave and Helen. You know, every time I just sit and chat with Dave, I get a sense that he, number one, understands where the church is today, but he understands where the church needs to go. And quite honestly, I travel the world, particularly all around Australia, and that's a rare attribute. Most pastors are desperately trying to keep churches in their current frame, but actually, I believe for the church worldwide to be successful, it has to think about what the church looks like in the future. Yeah. And the church in the future is very much about you going, not just about people coming. I want to talk to you today about an unusual topic. My church would say to that comment, they would say, Paul, all of your messages are unusual. And that's the way I do things. I want to ask you this question. Is it possible to go through life and succeed if all you ever do is add knowledge upon knowledge? Is it ever possible in your life where actually in order for you to grow, in order for you to succeed, you actually have to unlearn what you already know? Just ask him. Henry Ford says this, you can see on the screen. He says, anyone who stops learning, apparently learning's good, anyone who stops learning is old, whether at age 20 or 80. It's a good quote. I'm convinced. Benjamin Franklin says, tell me and I forget, teach me and I remember, involve me and I learn. Good. Nice. In fact, don't believe them, believe Jesus. Jesus said this, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your soul. So I've come all the way from Australia not to help you learn, but to help you unlearn. You've learned enough. Part of your problem is you know too much. We're going to unlearn some things today. Because actually, it's not just the gaining of knowledge that helps us be successful. Apparently, we actually have to stop and ask ourselves, is what we know really what God wants us to know? And is there anything about our life that God might want us to unravel or undo or just plain stop thinking? Who's heard of Dr. Carolyn Leaf? Yeah. Oh, good. Good company. If you don't know her, let me give you her accreditation, you might say. She's a cognitive neuroscientist. That's impressive. With a PhD in communication pathology, a BSc in logopedics and audiology, and she specializes in metacognitive and cognitive neuropsychology. That's even hard to say as an Australian, let alone as an English person, trust me. But she goes on, she says this about our thinking. She says 75 to 95% of the illnesses that plague us today are a direct result of our thought life. What we think about affects us physically and emotionally. In her book, Who Switched Off Your Brain? Nothing personal. She says that life learning experiences create neurological pathways in our brain to which our brain defaults to when an action is required. In other words, this is what she says. She says, you and I, through experience, education, and our cultural environment, have learned grooves of thinking to which in any given circumstance, you react with an action from that groove, believing that your action is absolutely true and right. But it's not necessarily based on truth. It could actually just be based on a groove of experience that you have. She goes on to say this, it's pretty powerful. She says that the average person has over 30,000 thoughts a day. That's the women. Just quite honestly, us men, we have about three. Yeah. Sometimes my wife says to me, she says, Paul, what are you really thinking? I say, honey, just absolutely nothing. This is the one gift men have. We are capable. I go out in my kayak, sit out in the ocean, and I can literally think about nothing all day. And I come home, I catch a few fish, and my wife's hoping that I'm thinking deeply about something. So, no, that's it. That's as deep as I went. How many fish I got in my kayak? It's a gift. She says this, that though through an uncontrolled thought life, we create the conditions of illness for illness, which make we literally make ourselves sick. Research shows that fear all on its own triggers more than 1,400 known physical and chemical responses and activates more than 30 different hormones. She goes on to say, many of us spend 7 days a week in the gym with our bodies trying to make them healthy and well, but we spend almost no time on our mind, in the mind of the gym of the mind, making sure that our thoughts are right. Romans 12:2 says this, don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into a new person by what? Changing the way you think. Isn't that interesting? Of all the things, particularly, I've been in a Pentecostal church all my life, and a lot of it's about heart, and it's about spirit, and it's about passion. But actually, I truly believe that the moment you give your life to Christ, nearly all of the work going on in your life is not to do with your spirit, but to do with your thinking. And actually today, if you're stuck in any area of your life, it's highly likely that you don't have a spirit problem, you probably have a thinking problem. And that's why the Apostle Paul made it absolutely clear that transformation happens when you let God change your thinking. He goes on to say, then you will learn to know God's will for you, which is good and pleasing and perfect. Before you know God's will for your life, you have to first let God transform your thinking. Yeah. I watched, I was a youth pastor for 13 years or something, and young people all the time trying to work out the will of God. What's the will of God? Don't be enamored by the will of God in the sense of that you're called every day of the week. Sometimes it looks really obvious what you're doing. It looks like a calling. But most of the time, it's everyday life and God's in it. We've over dramatized the call of God in your life. Just do what you've got right in your hands right now. Don't over-spiritualize it. You serve coffee in a cafe. According to the Bible, there's not a single thing you can do under God's name that is purposeless. There's nothing you can do in God, for God, that is purposeless. Serving a cup of coffee in a cafe is full of purpose because it's not what you do, it's who you do it for. Yeah. Which makes it purposeful. See, I keep going back into thank God it's Monday all the time. It's a trap for me, I tell you. I want to show you a video. I came across it. We've just about finished this series in our church. This is stuff we've been doing the last few weeks on unlearning. And when I was preparing for this series, I did what every good pastor does. I Googled unlearning, and up comes this video called The Backward Bike. I want to show it to you. Because you know the old saying, once you learn how to ride, you never forget. Well, this guy takes a bike, he re-engineers it so that when you turn right, it goes left. And when you turn left, it goes right. And I want you to watch this because it's a powerful illustration of entrenched thinking. That when you're trying to unlearn something and relearn something, how powerful the brain is. Have a look and we'll have some fun.
Hey, it's me, Destin. Welcome back to Smarter Every Day. You've heard people say it's just like riding a bike, meaning it's really easy and you can't forget how to do it, right? But I did something. I did something that damaged my mind. It happened on the streets of Amsterdam, and I got really scared, honestly. I can't ride a bike like you can anymore. Before I show you the video of what happened, I need to tell you the backstory. Like many six-year-olds with a MacGyver mullet, I learned how to ride a bike when I was really young. I had learned a life skill, and I was really proud of it. Everything changed, though, when my friend Barney called me 25 years later. Where I work, the welders are geniuses, and they like to play jokes on the engineers. He had a challenge for me. He had built a special bicycle, and he wanted me to try to ride it. He had only changed one thing. When you turn the handlebar to the left, the wheel goes to the right. When you turn it to the right, the wheel goes to the left. I thought this would be easy, so I hopped on the bike, ready to demonstrate how quickly I could conquer this.
And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Destin Sandlin. First attempt riding the bicycle.
All right. So, the faster I go, the better.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. You can see that I'm laughing, but I'm actually really frustrated. In this moment, I had a really deep revelation. My thinking was in a rut. This bike revealed a very deep truth to me. I had the knowledge of how to operate the bike, but I did not have the understanding. Therefore, knowledge is not understanding. Look, I know what you're probably thinking. Destin's probably just an uncoordinated engineer and can't do it. But that's not the case at all. The algorithm that's associated with riding a bike in your brain is just that complicated. I do not make definitive statements that often, but I'm telling you right now, you cannot ride this bicycle. You might think you can, but you can't. I know this because I'm often asked to speak at universities and conferences, and I take the bike with me. It's always the same. People think they're going to try some trick or they're just going to power through it. It doesn't work. Your brain cannot handle this. For instance, this guy. I offered him $200 just to ride this bike 10 feet across the stage. Everybody thought he could do it.
No, you didn't understand. So, this way. Whatever you're in.
Wait.
No, you have to keep your feet on. Alright, here we go.
Wait. Like, you gotta start rolling at least. And go.
Oh, God! Alright, back up. Okay, wait. Keep your feet on the pedal. Go.
Go right off.
Just keep your feet on the pedal. Come on.
Once you have a rigid way of thinking in your head, sometimes you cannot change that, even if you want to. So here's what I did. It was a personal challenge. I stayed out here in this driveway and I practiced about 5 minutes every day. My neighbors made fun of me. I had many wrecks, but after 8 months, this happened. One day I couldn't ride the bike and the next day I could. It was like I could feel some kind of pathway in my brain that was now unlocked. It was really weird though. It's like there's this trail in my brain, but if I wasn't paying close enough attention to it, my brain would easily lose that neural path and jump back onto the old road it was more familiar with. Any small distractions at all, like a cell phone ringing in my pocket, would instantly throw my brain back to the old control algorithm and I would wreck. But at least I could ride it.
So depending on your personality, some of you are sitting there and you're thinking, I could absolutely do that. Come on, hand up those of you, even now. Yep, I've met you before, actually. All around Australia, I've met you. And you're the ones that fail the first time, every time you do it. And so, hand up those of you who thought, why bother? I already know how to ride a bike. There's some of you people like that. What an effort. And then there's some people who go, look, I would never try and ride it, but it's hilarious watching other idiots try to do it. How many of those are doing that? Some of you are doing that. Well, I did like this guy in Australia. I went and got one made. Now, if I could have fitted it on the plane, I would have brought it with me. But I can tell you, after having over 50 people all around Australia get on stages and try and ride that bike, including myself, who I'm the type A, think I can do everything, I cannot ride it, and I promise you, you cannot ride it either. Because your brain is so wired up to do something that you have done for years that even though it looks like you can do it, you can't. And I've had people nearly fall off stages and crash into guitars and all sorts of things over these last few months. Why am I talking about it? Let me give you an example of a backward bike in the Bible. Grace. Grace is a backward bike. You know, in John chapter 3, I don't have too much time today, but Nicodemus talking to Jesus. And Jesus says, Nicodemus. See, Nicodemus came to meet Jesus because he was going to add to his already great knowledge about God. He was going to add this really cool stuff that Jesus was doing. So he came, Jesus, tell me about it because I'm going to add to my current knowledge. And Jesus said, no, buddy, unless you unlearn what you once knew and relearn what I'm telling you today, you cannot be born again. It was said once that you were saved by, or you were in God's family by following the law. I'm telling you, you are incapable of doing that. You're going to need me. Grace is a backward bike because everything in your thinking, when you do something wrong, says to you, you cannot be a Christian, you cannot lift your hands, you cannot pray, you cannot read your Bible, because I know what you did, your brain says. But it is by grace that we've been saved. I would say, just quietly, between you and I, it took me years to live by grace. I grew up in the church. I honestly thought that the goal of every male in the church was that I was supposed to become a nice guy. That apparently, nobody said it, but it looked like the outcome of Christian men was that I would become nice. The problem was I was really bad at it. And so I realized the goal of Christian men is not that they become nice, tamed, claws cut off, no strength, no fight, no grunt. I realized that I could be fully strong, fully courageous, lead with strength, yet by the same time, live by grace. Very good. I want to talk to you about Matthew 5 this morning. I want you to grab your devices there quickly. Google the Bible. I'm just going to read this from the Message because I love the picture. I actually think that Matthew chapter 5, by the way, is unlearning. You read Matthew chapter 5, we won't get through all of it today, of course, but Jesus says things like this. You've heard it said, but. You used to live like this. You've heard it said, eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, don't resist an evil person. That's an unlearning thought. Verse 1, when Jesus saw his ministry drawing huge crowds, he climbed a hillside, and those who were apprenticed to him, I like that picture, the committed, climbed with him. Arriving at a quiet place, he sat down and taught his climbing companions, and this is what he said. We'll go through a couple in a second. Here's a picture, and I love this. Here's what didn't happen. Jesus was not down at the base of the mountain and makes an announcement to the crowd, hey, everybody, I'm just letting you know, me and the boys, we're heading up the mountain and you need to stay here. Because Jesus knew something about crowds. The moment it required effort, energy, elevation, hard work, all he needed to do was ascend, and only those that truly were his climbers would go. By the way, they're the kind of people I'm looking for to help me build the church. Because I get crowds the moment I've had to teach my church that change is a normal for us. Because our church, Lighthouse, is we rewired it to exist for the thousands of people outside the church that never come on Sundays. Did you know that people in Wigan are not waking up Sunday mornings thinking what's a great church they can go to? And so you have to unlearn the idea that the goal of you being in a church is that if you could just work on your friend for 6 months or a year, hopefully get them here, and then Dave will weave his magic and they will give their life to Christ. I think the future of the church is where we train mature Christians who know how to disciple people, not when they come to church, but from the day they meet them. We're going to shift that thing whole round. Here's the other thing I noticed about that passage. I love this. You ever notice that as a pastor, sometimes I get people, they give their lives to Christ, and on the same day they give their life to Christ, they get healed. Yet I've got people in my church who have been believing for healing for 20 years and still not healed. And I'm thinking, what? They just came from the crowd, they got saved, they got healed. When you go through the New Testament, you will notice that Jesus did instantaneous miracles for the crowd, but he only did maybe one, maybe two instant miracles for the disciples. I'm going to say something to you that's going to shock you. I believe in miracles, but I'm going to suggest to you today that God does instant for the crowd, but he does process for his disciples. Because he's changing your thinking. So you can say today, I've been believing for a miracle for ages and we should keep believing, but actually maybe not all the time, but sometimes God doesn't just want to go instant miracle. God is trying to say, if I do the miracle, you won't learn what I'm trying to change in your thinking. For example, we're about to read, blessed are the poor in spirit, or those who lack something. And just use money for example. Listen, if you're struggling with finance, you don't want an instant miracle. The worst thing that could happen to you, Jesus didn't walk up to his disciples when he said that, slapped his hand on their forehead and said, in the name of myself, poverty, come out. He sat down and he taught them about how to deal with poverty. Actually, if you're struggling with finance, it's possible you don't need a miracle. It's possible you need a budget. Process. With the crowd, he does instant miracles, but with the disciples, he took the time to help them unlearn and relearn. You don't believe me? So we'll keep going. Matthew 5:3. The scripture I just read, but in the Message version. I love the heading, by the way, of my Bible at the top of this scripture. It says, take a second look. I actually think that's the essence of unlearning. If you want to become an unlearner, you have to have a spirit or an attitude that says, I know I've been doing this a certain way for a long period of time, but I probably should take a second look. Matthew 5:3, you're blessed when you're at the end of your rope, because with less of you, there is more of God and his rule. Now, don't put your hands up, but we're just going to check something. How many of you, last time you were at the end of your rope, said, this is awesome, I feel blessed? None of you, right? Because your brain and our culture has taught us that the very instant you feel overwhelmed, overrun, can't cope, is the normal and actual response is to give up and quit. But Jesus says, no, I'm telling you, contrary to a pathway of thinking, I'm telling you that actually when you're at the end of your rope, you'll finally discover that I'm everything you need. That's unlearning. Dr. Karen Leaf taught that our feelings come from how we think. And I think more than ever, we live in a generation that lives by feelings. Because I had that thought, I had that problem, it has an equal corresponding feeling to which I should express it. But I think God has a different way. I want to encourage you today. If you do feel at the end of your rope, you're not at the end of your rope. Yeah. God's right there. Yeah, that's right. You are about to discover the God that you didn't know while you were holding onto the rope. Right. You are about to discover the God of no rope. You are about to discover in a deeper way a God that has got you when you haven't got yourself. Yeah. Very good. We need to learn the mantra, or unlearn the mantra that we have no choice. You do have a choice, even when you're overwhelmed. You know, in Matthew 5:4, in the Message again, it says, you're blessed when you feel you've lost what is most dear to you. No, I'm not. No, it's not the feeling that comes to mind. I mean, don't you ever argue with the Bible? I'm just not going to say it because it sounds good. No. Sorry, I'm just having a moment. No, Lord. When I've lost people dear to me, which I have, Lord, by the way, I don't feel blessed. But according to this, it's not that we're blessed. By the way, blessed means approved by God. Approved by God are those who, when they lose someone, something close to them, recognizes that now they can be embraced by the one who loves them most. What's he saying? Saying, listen, when you lose someone something and it's devastating. I want you to know, Jesus said, you're not climbing that mountain alone. That I am at the center of that loss. I'm in the middle. You will never, under Jesus, do loss by yourself. This is my favorite. Matthew 5:5. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. What? Oh, come on. I don't know about you, but in Australia, when we think of meek, we think of the word that rhymes with meek, weak. So, I'm asking a few questions, I know, but I'm going to ask one. When was the last time when you did your resume for your job, at the very top of your resume you put, I am meek? Jesus said, no, but it says the meek will inherit the earth. Sounds fairly valuable. I don't know what you have here. We have the Australian Defence Force. Not necessary. We live that far away. Nobody could be bothered. Nobody wants to invade us. Like you can't even get the fuel to go one distance there. So you know we don't really need a defence force. But nonetheless, so I don't know what it is here. The England Defence Force, whatever it is. But I guarantee you, in their slogan, they're not saying, we're just looking for men and women who are meek. I bet you that's not in the ad. Because nobody thinks meekness is a quality that we're supposed to pursue. So it's fair to say we've either got it wrong or we have to unlearn what meekness is. So this is what the Webster Dictionary, chose my good English dictionary. So this is what it says meekness is. It says that it is deficient in spirit and courage. It's not going well. It says docile. Not my resume. Mouse-like. Like a little mouse in the corner with his little whiskers. I don't really think... I was the chaplain for a professional basketball team for 17 years. And not once did I hear them refer to each other as, I love Johnny, so meek. Never. It's just, to me, not a trait that anybody seems to want anymore. But then as I'm researching, unlearning, because I'm really saying, God, come on. It reads so beautifully, but I don't really agree. So I thought, what is it about what I know that's not right that I need to unlearn and relearn? Because that's what Matthew 5 is. Matthew 5 just, it preaches great until you're going through it. Here's what that word meek means in the Greek. It means prowess or prowess, P-R-A-U-S. It's a term that describes the domestication of wild animals. That is the description of meekness. Wild horses, while they're wild, they can also appear beautiful, rugged, courageous, running through those hills. But really, all they're interested in is eating grass and roaming. They're actually no good to humans whatsoever while they're wild. A wild horse's agenda does not include having a saddle strapped to its back and you riding it. It's not its agenda. It never thinks of it. But I dug in deep and found this incredible letter in the 4th century from a Greek soldier who had just won the war between Sparta and Athens. He was missing his wife and he found a white stallion, wild. And he brought it in and tamed it and sent it to his wife as a coming home gift after the war. He wrote this letter to her and this is how he described the stallion, because I want to describe it today because I think it perfectly describes what it means to be meek. He said this, he said, it is the most magnificent animal I've ever seen. It responds obediently with the slightest touch of the reins. It allows its master to direct him to its full potential. It is indeed a prowess horse. Doesn't sound like weakness to me. Here's the picture of meekness. That you and I would surrender our life in such a way that when God comes to direct, when God comes to discipline, that every time he doesn't have to he's not trying to reap at the reins, and you know you got the bridle's kind of up around your ear because he's having or you're like the Joker out of Batman, you got scars running up the side of your face, because God getting you and I to do something is so much work that even God's getting tired. The picture of meekness is that God would come to you and I, and with just a gentle tug of the reins, you would say, "Yes, Lord. Lord, I would be, I don't want to, but I know you, Master. I trust your purposes. I trust your will." You know, my mother, I'm nearly 52. I know most of you are thinking 35. Anybody? Just show of hands. Anybody thinking 35? Just to encourage me. Thank you back there for lying. Appreciate that. And so my mother, I hear, she's in my church still, Mum. And I hear her describing to other people in my church, I'm the senior pastor, that Paul, growing up, was like a wild horse that needed breaking in. How rude is that? I'm the flippin' pastor. I have to say to my mum sometimes, she said, "Mum, I was like 13. I'm nearly 52. That's how bad I was." She's scarred. I was a wild teenager. Wild. And my mum and dad desperately tried to rein me in. But I tell you what happened to me. See, I'm the kind of person where, honestly, I could have gone one of either direction. I could, like I am today, a leader and a force for God. I could have easily been a force for darkness, like any teenager. But actually what happened was God, by his hand, he constantly, by using problems, offense, circumstance, people. Wouldn't church be great if it wasn't for the people? And he uses all those things, and he brought that power that was on my life under control. You are useless to God unless you can be power under control. You don't have to lose your strength. You don't have to lose your individuality. You don't have to use your beauty, your courage, your magnificence, but you do have to let God bring it under control. You can spend your whole life, teenager, if you're here today, I'm a church kid, I've been in church, I can't remember ever not being in church. But I can tell you something. You have been made for God's purposes. By all means, be rebellious, but it will be the greatest regret of your life. Because you have been made. And you know that pressure you feel from parents, that pressure you feel from teachers, from society? That's God trying to get you tamed for his purposes. Resist it all you like. But what I've found is this. We do homeless youth housing. Take 45 young people off the street every year, put them through our program. Those young people would say to you, if it's not me today, they would say, "We were foolish to kick against those who God brought around to realign our lives for purpose." And they had to do the whole hard yards, the drugs, the living on the street, damage their lives, years of rehabilitation. And I'm telling you, it was close for me one day. It was close. But I let God tame me. You want to know what meekness is? Meekness is power under control. I'm going to give you three things. Power under control, which is not loss of power or strength. It's being tamed for God's purposes. And it's yielding to the will of God. You know, there's only two people in the Bible that are described as meek. Moses and Jesus. Moses, if we take the Webster dictionary, docile, mouse-like? Don't think so. There's only one reason why Moses, and by the way, Moses wrote that line about he's the meekest person in the world. Which changes meekness again. Doesn't mean never talk.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean never speak up. Doesn't mean don't stand up for yourself. Moses, in fact, was not deficient in courage, like the Webster Dictionary says.
Yeah.
Moses was powerful in action and speech. In his early life, he was a general in an army. Yeah. Led tens of thousands of men in a battle. He once killed a man with his bare hands for attacking one of the Israelites. He led 2, most likely 3 million people, if you count children, 2 to 3 million stubborn people for 40 years. And the Numbers 12 describes him, Moses, as the meekest person on earth. Huh. What? And the only way he can describe that way is for this one reason. When Moses stood at the burning bush and God told him to go to Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world, go tell him to let my people go, Moses said what? I don't want to do it. I do not want to do it. You know why Moses is meek? Because he did it anyway.
Yeah.
Wow. He said, not my will, Lord.
Yeah.
Yours. You want to know what meekness is? Meekness is when you're faced with a situation that you know God wants you to do, but you don't want to do it, but you decide to do it anyway. That's meekness. I know today, because I lead a church, and part of it's true, I think, the modern version of destiny. You know, almost like, don't worry, you're going to fulfill all of your plans and purposes. God wants you to, you know, whatever's on your heart, he wants you to do. Like, I get that some of that's right, but I've got a question. Sorry for the questions. What if your destiny is doing something you don't want to do? Where did all that go? You know, I think of Steve here, my friend, who's just literally doing amazing things across Europe, planning, raising up and planting churches through local leaders. And I reckon there'd be times in his life, even that his big move, you know, from beautiful Australia over here to England, you know, he used to just lay by the beach doing nothing. At least that's how I imagine it. And now he's just working 24/7 to raise up leaders. I'm sure there are days where that doesn't feel like the destiny. I'm not saying God doesn't work with your passions. I'm just saying, if your philosophy is that God would never ask you to do something you don't want to do, then you've got little G God and he lives in your pocket. Look at him. Oh, isn't he cute? Little G God. Small God. Small enough to boss around. Shh, shh. But big G God. I found in my short life that God asked me to do things I want to run from. I mean, I tell leaders, when I talk to leaders, just quite honestly, I lead a great church, Lighthouse, but it's pressure, man. I just became the state president. I'm now responsible for 330 churches. I got pressure. I just want you to know, just come close, just between you and I. Don't tell anybody else. I want to quit every second week. But only the people that don't want to quit, they don't have a dream. That's why they don't want to quit. Nobody wants to quit from nothing. You only feel like you want to quit because you know your life's significant. So I make quitting my friend. I go, oh, quitting. I haven't seen you for at least 2 weeks. Come close. Let's have a little hug. I acknowledge that quitting is a part of anybody that is fulfilling God's purpose. Because fulfilling God's purpose is tough, man. It's difficult. And lastly, Jesus. Jesus, who is also, according to his words, meek. He radiated power. He wasn't docile. He confronted the oppressive religious structures head on in Matthew 23. You whitewashed tombs. He fashioned a whip and drove out the money changers and the thieves from his father's house. In matters of truth and in the face of evil, he was a lion, but when he was under personal attack, he was a lamb. Good picture of meekness. Didn't spend his energy defending himself, spent his energy defending others. In 1 Peter 2:23, he did not retaliate when he was insulted, nor threaten revenge when he suffered. He left his case in the hands of God who always judges. We're done. I wonder today, just as we finish, take it from a church kid, honestly, who made a decision at 17 years of age when I felt, won't you just stand for a moment? Well, I honestly felt that the goal of Christianity was that I just behave better than I used to behave. It was, and I said to the Lord at 17 years of age, I said to the Lord, Lord, I'm sure you're nice, but if this whole deal is about me trying to be good, I'm going to struggle. God, it's not that I don't want to be good. Don't hear me wrong, Lord. It's not that I don't want to be good. It's just I find I'm not real good at being good. And so, God, today I wasn't good, so I feel like I'm not a Christian. And tomorrow, Lord, I'm hoping I'll be good and then I can feel like a Christian. And I lived for years based on how I sinned or didn't sin. I was saved when I didn't sin. I was unsaved when I did sin. And I said, Lord, it's too much pressure. Can't do it anymore. And I had an encounter with God where God said, Paul, the whole reason I died was because I'm aware in your nature you're not able to be good. But if you could trust me, if you could focus on me, not on trying to be good, focus on me, relationship, then I'm going to help you. All those other things, we'll do those in time. We'll do it under grace and not under law. You know, set me free. I want to ask you today, I wonder how many people are here. You've been riding the bike of self-punishment. You've been riding the bike of trying to make yourself better. You've been riding the bike of self-approval. Would you be willing today to take a huge step and say, God, I need to learn a backward bike. I'm going to find rest in you, Jesus. I'm not going to try to be something. I'm just going to be with you. I'm going to let your grace, your blood, wash over my life.